May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
Good afternoon and welcome to Attention Please. KPTZ airs Attention Please to draw our attention to the good work being done towards building a better informed and more resilient community. I'm Phil Andrus. The topic of this week's Attention Please is the Jefferson County Conservation Futures Program, a function of Jefferson County government. With me are Tammy Picorni, Natural Resources Program Coordinator within the Department of Environmental Health, Luke Strong-Civich, Tribal Planning Director for the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe, Eric Kingfisher, who is the Stewardship Director for Jefferson Land Trust, and Scott Freeman, a rural landowner who has participated in that capacity in Conservation Futures. Welcome to you all. One element of Conservation Futures is the Citizen Oversight Committee, a group of presently 13 citizens who advise the Board of County Commissioners on the allocation of Conservation Futures funds. I am one of the 13 and have been for a couple of decades. Conservation Futures Funds, I use that term. Tammy Picorni, I turn to you for a brief overview of Conservation Futures, its history as established by the legislature and adopted in Jefferson County by the Board of County Commissioners.
Thank you, Phil. The Conservation Futures Program is funded by the Conservation Futures Tax, which is Chapter 3.07 of the county's code, as defined by RCW 84.34.230. The Conservation Futures Program was established by the legislature several years before the county took action on it in 2002 in order to protect lands and public interest for future generations and as a tool for salmon habitat preservation. Our fund collects 3.65 cents per $1,000 in property valuation. It adds up to 0.39% of the real and personal property taxes collected in 2022, which equals $259,312. So it's the county's smallest levy. An owner of a $250,000 property would contribute just over $9 per year towards this fund. And they're used by project sponsors towards the purchase of land or conservation easements from willing sellers. Each dollar of county funds must be matched at least one-to-one by other funds, such as private donations or state and federal grants. Over the last 20 years or so, there have been more than 50 projects awarded funding and just over $4 million expended.
So 50 projects, that's 50 projects, and a good deal of money brought into the county from outside. Outside sources are which sources?
Private donations. Sometimes the owners of the properties themselves make what is termed a bargain sale possible. In other words, they donate a portion of the fair market value of what they're selling to the project itself. Very frequently, there are grant funds tapped through an application process similar to Conservation Futures Fund. So it takes a tremendous amount of effort on the part of the sponsor to put together a package. Sometimes they go out to the community and solicit funds. And of course, I'm thinking of the Jefferson Land Trust primarily. They're one of the most frequent sponsors to this program.
So we have a couple of case studies. Now, that general background helps us understand what the program is about. The case studies, I've already referenced them, the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe's project with Tamanimus Rock, and then Scott Freeman's project, his place down on the Tarboo Valley. Tamanimus Rock is a place I know. I visited Tamanimus Rock before I even lived here, but I would imagine many listeners do not know where it is or what it is. Maybe they've seen it and wondered. Maybe they haven't seen it at all. To begin with, Luke, what is this rock? Why is it important? And what is its history?
Hi, thanks, Phil. Well, I guess let me start off by introducing myself as the planner for the Jamestown Tribe. I have some responsibility to help the tribe steward its lands. Tamanimus Rock is a special place to the Jamestown Tsklallam and to the Port Gamble Tsklallam and to the Lower Elwha Tsklallam people. And it's also important to some other tribes. I should mention that I'm not a citizen of the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe or any other tribe for that matter. I'm a staff person for the tribe and represent the tribe where and when appropriate. So on this interview, I think it's important to mention that I am speaking about someone else's culture, not my own. Tamanimus Rock is located off of Anderson Lake Road, adjacent to Anderson Lake State Park. It's a big rock, about 150 feet tall, and it's an old rock. We can get into the geology as we kind of move forward, but it's culturally significant to the Sklallam people for a number of reasons. I think there is some utility in the location of the rock. 10,000 years ago, it was a good place to go to get a view, but it also holds quite a bit of cultural and spiritual significance. It was a place where people would go to pray. Tamanowos means spirit power in the Sklallam language. A place that's referenced as spirit power obviously has some importance to the people who visited it for spiritual purposes. I'm not entirely qualified to talk about what those spiritual purposes are. I wouldn't want to misrepresent anybody's understanding of the rock, what it means to them. There's kind of a long history of folks going there, stories of people spending time on top of the rock, cleansing their bodies, cleansing their spirit, fasting. It's a magnificent spot.
You referenced the geology. There has been quite a bit of study by a, I believe now emeritus professor at University of Puget Sound, Jeff Tepper, about the rock itself and similar bits of rock elsewhere, including, in fact, in my very own neighborhood. What do you know beyond what you've said about the geology and why it's unique?
Well, it's old. As I understand it, the rock is older than the rest of the Olympics, so it came up in a different geologic period. Eric, he's our local expert geologist. The paper you referenced by Mr. Tepper is that he did an exceptional job. It's almost like a scientific peer-reviewed published paper. But I would defer to Eric to talk about some of the specifics around the geology of Tamanowos Rock.
Please do, Eric.
I'm no expert in geology, but I just love this stuff. And I love that Tamanowos Rock, and I love that we're having a conversation about Tamanowos Rock right now. And I love that you're sharing that through KPTZ, Phil. This is wonderful. It's a really special place, and it's been a special place for people for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Has Western science and the sort of Western perspective recognized just how unusual and significant it is in the whole geologic story of the Northwest. As Luke mentioned, it's very old. It's about 47 million years old. And it's a result of a volcano that was right in that area, within about 10 miles of that area. And the volcano erupted and created this earth and ash flow that filled the valley. And then that the valley walls eroded and retained. And so then there was just a ridge on the landscape. And then that ridge kind of eroded in the way it did and it produced this rock feature that you see today. Why was there a volcano there is another really fun part of this whole dynamic that I think is important to recognize, is that there were two subducting plates next to each other and subducting under the North American plate. And they were spreading apart. And as they were spreading apart, that created a very hot spot in the crust. And that hot spot then created a volcano. And this is at a time when there was like no Olympics, there was no Cascades. The geologists think this was some sort of big coastal plain environment. And this is also when the Silesia terrain was accreting onto the North American plate, which stopped subduction for 15 million years. And that's kind of why those underlying plates broke off. So big complicated story. But what I think the most important thematic understanding I want people to have is Tamanowos Rock represents the change between that old landscape, a very, very ancient landscape, pre-Cascade, pre-Olympic landscape. It represents that point when everything's changed. And after Tamanowos Rock was formed, that is when the Cascades started to become formed. That's when the Olympics started to become formed. So it's a real punctuation mark in the geologic story of our Pacific Northwest landscape.
And then we skip ahead a very long while, and we find that this geologic formation has been used by Native people, but it's under threat, not by Native people, but by especially one European ancestor developer. Describe the threat and describe how the land trust and the tribe and other entities helped to preserve the rock. Obviously, the rock is the rock. It would take a lot of chipping away to hurt it physically, but nevertheless, to show it the proper respect.
It was privately owned at one point by a developer who had the intention of building housing there. It was going to be developed as a home site. When I took the job, I actually heard that the developer had the intention of blowing up the rock to use as some potential fill to build pads for homes. that is when this kind of community coalition came together. I think Gene Jones from the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe deserves a lot of credit for taking the initial stand. He had memories of visiting the rock that he shared with me when he was a young boy with his grandpa, who was telling him, you know, this is an important place. At some point, we might need to protect this place. And sure enough, that time came. The Jamestown tribe actually wasn't the first owner, but with the support of the Jefferson Land Trust, was able to acquire the rock itself. If you're trying to protect culturally significant places, sometimes you have to start small and then expand out. And that's exactly what happened with Tamanuas Rock, where the rock was acquired and it was protected. And then some of the surrounding lands around the rock were also acquired and protected. And when I say protected, the Jefferson Land Trust, partnering with the Jamestown Sklallam tribe after the tribe acquired it, there was a conservation easement placed on the rock, which prohibits future development and preserves what culturally important place for the Sklallam people, what also is a important place for amateur geologists.
Describe the role of the Land Trust in putting together what I will call a coalition of interested parties to protect not just the rock, but the land around it, which is necessary to really properly protect the rock.
It's important to recognize that people have been sort of magnetized to the rock for thousands of years, including these last couple hundred years or last 150 years. People have loved this place, and to the point where there's been a lot of abuse up there as well. But when I first moved here, that was on my second day of work. That's where Sarah Spaeth took me to talk about the place, this place that we're working in now. It was a very important part of the landscape, and it was not yet protected. But she also similarly said, we hope to be able to help protect this because the current landowner does threaten it with some sort of abuse and conversion. And sure enough, about a year later, he put it up for sale, and we ended up helping organize a bit of a coalition as a land trust with Jamestown Sklallam Tribe and with the state parks. They actually got involved too, because it's right adjacent to the Anderson Lake State Parks. And so with that collective, we were able to work with the landowner to come to an agreement that we would be interested in making an offer at an appraised value, that he would sell it at an appraised value. And so we found a third-party appraiser to come up with an appraisal value, and it was found all sorts of different ways to pull in some money, including some financing. We had to take out a loan to acquire that property from some private philanthropic foundation that gave us a low interest loan to hold it for a little while. In the end, the tribe had been able to acquire a 20-acre piece of property just to the north of the rock already in about a few years prior, and we'd helped establish a conservation easement on that. And so when we were able to acquire the conservation easement and then transfer that over to the Jamestown Sklallam tribe, we were able to then amend the existing conservation easement to include more of that acreage. So now it's an 84-acre area that the Jamestown Sklallam tribe owns and is protected with a conservation easement. So that in perpetuity, it'll remain this important sanctuary that has all these habitat and water quality values, as well as all this cultural heritage importance for the people now and in the past and in the future.
And Tammy, what part did Conservation Futures play in this assembling of organizations and funds?
Through our normal application process, the tribe requested, I think it was just under $70,000. So it was, I'm sure, a relatively minor piece in the financial picture, but I think also a very important one. And that's the case oftentimes with Conservation Futures. It will provide seed money to a new project, or it'll provide the very last piece necessary to make a project happen on the ground.
And Luke, I know it's important to you that our listeners hear that we're not welcome to come scrambling up and down and around and across the face of the rock, for example. There's restrictions placed by the land trust, I meant to say, and by the tribe for how we can enjoy the rock. Everyone can enjoy the rock.
It's a unique, special place. I think I should also point out, in addition to the conservation easement that the Jefferson Land Trust holds on Tamanuas Rock, it's also on the State and National Registry of Historic Places due to its cultural significance to tribes. So that's an additional level of protection. As far as what the conservation easement allows and forbids, that's kind of up to Jefferson Land Trust. But the rock being a true sanctuary to the tribe, it holds a lot of the same kind of standards that you'd find in a house of worship or something like that, where you want to be respectful there. You don't want to come and think that just because this place is protected and it's open to the public, that anything I would do at Anderson Lake State Park is entirely appropriate there. Part of the tribe's interest in protecting the rock was to provide a place, or to protect the place where people traditionally went as a sanctuary, and to continue that on. One of the big issues when the rock was acquired, it's a big rock. It was a good place to rock climb, but that's not necessarily compatible with someone who's going to spend time at a place for spiritual reasons. There's a church across the street from my house. They have an organ. I like to play the piano, but I know that's not the organ that I just walk through the door of the church and start jamming on. And it's the same, I guess, the same analogy that you could bring to Tamanuas Rock. Sklallam people would see it as disrespectful if somebody decided that they're going to go start hosting, you know, a yoga class at the bottom of the rock, or if they wanted to build a dirt bike jump behind the rock. That's not necessarily compatible with the tribe's intentions of protecting it as a sanctuary. Some common sense and some respect go a long ways. Folks are there. They're interested in the geology. The tribe's going to help facilitate that. If you got a second grade class from the Chimicum School District who wants to come up there to learn a little bit about the natural environment and a little bit about the tribe's history in the area, we're going to support that as well. It's been a shift, but I think the community as a whole has kind of come together to help steward that place. When the tribe first acquired it, people had been accustomed to this kind of unclear ownership. There's a lot of land, a lot of trails. So some folks just weren't educated. And one of the investments in education the tribe's interested in making is just helping people be better stewards of the environment, including Tamanuas Rock.
We talked about Tamanuas Rock for its own sake, because it's great interest and value to everybody nearby and perhaps far away, people who know, but also as a case study of conservation and the use of the Conservation Futures Program. Second case study is in Taboo Valley. And to that and for that, I turn to Scott Freeman, who lives in that area and who owns the land in question. And I would like Scott to begin by talking about this piece of land and how it was when you found it, what you had to do and what you continue to do to restore it, and how Conservation Futures got involved.
My family and I had been looking for a restoration project for a long time, and finally had scraped together some financial capacity and went looking for a piece of land. And through Jefferson Land Trust, actually, a recommendation connected us with Northwest Watershed Institute, who wanted to do a project on the Taboo Creek at a parcel along Daybob Road. And we looked at it and looked at the asking price and said, oh my gosh, this is way steeper than what we can really do right now as a family. And that's really very early where Conservation Futures stepped in, is that relatively small grant from the program helped secure an easement so that in perpetuity, our family and whoever ends up stewarding the land in the future will manage it for the benefit of the public and specifically for salmon habitat and restoration. Because when we started the project, and that's actually what made it happen. Again, at that time, we simply could not afford to do a conservation project without help from the citizens of Jefferson County through Conservation Futures. So we are eternally grateful for this program. And as Tammy said, it functions as a catalyst. It's like lighting a little match and then watching things explode down the road. I was looking over the list of funded projects just the other day in preparation for this conversation. And it's amazing how many high-profile farmland and natural area restoration projects or areas of cultural significance like the Rock have been really triggered and made possible by Conservation Futures. And that was definitely a big part of our story at Taboo Creek.
And I had assumed it was land that you already owned that might even have been a place where you were living. But in fact, you had a goal of preserving a piece of land. You had everything to realize that goal, but the land and the money. And
Details. Yeah, we wanted to do a project. My wife and I had actually met at the Leopold Reserve, if listeners know his legacy as a conservationist. And we'd done some restoration work there before moving to the Pacific Northwest many, many, many years ago. That was what Taboo Creek meant to us, was the chance to carry on her family's legacy. And yes, it was really Conservation Futures that got our family's involvement started.
So people buy land, I would say more often than not, to in one way or another make money. In other words, as a financial investment, you have made an investment of a different sort. And it doesn't sound like it to me that you're going to reap any kind of significant profit from what you've done. monetary profit, that is.
No, in fact, the terms of the easement on the original parcel that we bought are very restricted. It's an 18-acre parcel right along Center Road, and it has the really important stretch of Tarboo Creek flowing through it, important in terms of salmon habitat. When we bought it, it deeply degraded salmon habitat had been incised and channelized by previous landowners, and so the creek was pretty much shot through the area that we were committed to working on. And we wanted to do this as a family project. Subsequently, again, with this theme of catalysis, catalyzing effect of conservation futures, when our financial situation improved and we've been able to buy some forest land in adjacent to Tarboo Creek and very near this original property, that we've put easements on that are held by Jefferson Land Trust. There, we're actually able to donate some of the easement value for matches. We've been able to sort of give back a little bit, both directly through that matching program donation, and we're managing these forests for sustainable forestry now under the terms of easements. So they're contributing to the local economy and our family's well-being as well.
When the day may come when you and your family want to sell the property, or possibly your sons, one or both, will inherit the property, what restrictions are put upon it, and how will those restrictions limit their ability to sell the property, or your ability to sell the property?
Yeah, great question. The easements, as Eric can explain in more detail, can be written essentially to the landowner's needs or wants. But to qualify for, and Tammy can speak to qualify for support from Conservation Futures and the citizens of Jefferson County, Tammy and the review board want to know there's a public benefit that is going to be felt by everyone. The way you write an easement depends. And again, on this initial 18 acres, it's extremely restrictive in terms of what we can do. So there's a very large public benefit and wildlife benefit. We have a 1-acre envelope where we can camp or do things as a family. And that's been wonderful for us. That's served all of our needs on the property. When we sell it, the easement goes with it. I often tell people, the easement aren't for us. My family and my wife and I are committed to conservation and open space and trying to restore good habitat for salmon and grow some big trees so our kids and grandkids can enjoy them and reinforce the things that all of us love about Jefferson County. The easement's there for a couple of generations down the road when I don't have to think too hard and think, well, what if this family member who married in or is a direct line got in charge of this place? It would be gone in a heartbeat because they don't have the same value system that we do. But that's when the land trust will step in, potentially 100 or 200 years from now and say, I'm sorry, this was set up and these were the goals and we're here to make sure that's true.
And part of Eric Kingfisher's job is just that, enforcing the easement.
Yeah, that's right. That was really well said. Thank you, Scott. That was really great. And indeed, I should say, for all the listeners, not everybody maybe knows what Jefferson Land Trust is or what a land trust is. So just briefly, we're a nonprofit land conservation group, and we're just really working within Jefferson County. We're dedicated to permanent land conservation work here in Jefferson County. And really, it's a private land conservation model of conservation. So we work with landowners all over the place in Jefferson County where there's conservation values. And we're helping as a nonprofit, community-driven organization to help ensure these conservation values are there for future generations. We're really trying to always think out, 100 years or more with these kinds of conservation projects. And we get to work with amazing people like our friends at Jamestown Squab Tribe and friends like Scott and his family. And we have, I think, about 65 conservation easements across the county at this point. We also own about 25 different nature preserves. And we've helped protect somewhere around 17,000 acres of land in this county alone through partnerships, all these different arrangements.
Eric, what would happen, now Scott knows this is hypothetical and I'm not being suspicious of him, but let us just say that the Freeman family decides to put in a go-kart track.
Yeah.
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 What would you do?
That's great. You'd get a go-kart, right? I could get a call from Scott who's like, hey, Eric, I'm ready to put in a go-kart track. Can you just check the conservation easement and make sure that's okay? Then I could look at the conservation easement and indeed it would not be okay. And I know that easement well enough to say that right now. As Scott said, each conservation easement is really customized for the property itself, the conservation values that are there and that need to be protected and the interest and the values and the mission of the land trust and the interest and values of the landowner. And we find that sweet spot and we create a crafted document, a permanent document document that helps ensure that those conservation values are going to be there over time. The salmon habitat values, the productive forest values, or even the agricultural farmland values. We do lots of different kinds of conservation. And so what that would look like is if there were a landowner, you know, that said, hey, we want to do this big conversion project and take this piece of forest and turn it into a go-kart track or something, then we could say, oh, you must misunderstand these precise words that we have here that is a fundamental part of this, you know, your deed of your property. And the land trust is responsible and obligated, in fact, to ensure that things like that don't occur. The conversion of that space does not occur. In fact, that forest needs to stay the way it is, or whatever the easement says, that forest needs to be like that. And if that landowner were to persist in that plan and say, no, I really want to do this and I have a bulldozer ready to go, then we have to get into a legal position and actually prevent that legally. And that's where our attorneys get involved, and we use things like litigation if we have to. But that's a very rare occasion, because we generate really strong understanding among all of our partners and our landowners together to make sure we're on the same page about this. And occasionally there are violations, though, and that is absolutely something the land trust does follow through on and ensures that those violations are resolved.
But so far, no go-kart tracks, as far as I know. So, Tammy Pokorny, I want to turn to you to bring this to a close. Conservation Futures is supported by a property tax. It's very tiny, as you said, but still, there's probably some taxpayers who resent even this tiny tax. Does the program have the support of the Board of Commissioners?
It has. My best metric on that is just that almost without exception, the Board of County Commissioners accepts the recommendations of the Conservation Futures Citizen Oversight Committee, which is a group of citizen volunteers, 13 people who meet several times a year to evaluate the applications for funding that come in the spring. And they visit those sites and hear presentations and then complete a score sheet and rank the projects and then provide a formal recommendation to the commissioners. And it's obviously the commissioners to make the final call on what is funded. But it seems that there's quite a bit of alignment as we go through that process.
If a listener has property that said listener thinks might be appropriate for Conservation Futures, how would the listener begin conversation? It would probably begin with you. What's the process? Very briefly, because we're edging towards way too much time here. What's the process? Call you on the phone?
Yes, exactly. Write an email, search Jefferson County Conservation Futures Program, and you'll find our website and lots of information there about meetings and projects and my phone number and email us. I sure welcome those calls. I really enjoy speaking to folks.
Okay, I want to thank you all for this conversation. There's music in the background at this point. I've opted to close the conversation about Conservation Futures with a few moments from Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which is called The Pastoral, appropriately here, performed by the London Classical Players. Thanks to Tammy Pokorny, Luke Strong-Sevich, Scott Freeman, and Eric Kinksolver. Attention Please is aired each Monday at noon and at 5 and on Saturdays at noon on Community Radio KPTZ, which continues, that is, KPTZ does with its Welcome Home Fall fundraiser. If programs such as Attention Please are important to you, please support them by donating to KPTZ at kptz.org. Find the Donate Now button and select the amount of your donation and whether it's to be a one-time donation or a sustaining membership. Thank you for listening and for donating. I'm Phil Andrus.